WMFO Medford.
WMFO in Medford.
91.5 FM WMFO.
On 91.5 WMFO Medford.
Tufts Freeform Radio.
thought that turned us from lovers to friends. I'm thinking I should take that volume back up off the shelf and crack its weary spine and read to help remind myself. But if I move my place in mine, I'll lose.
Your favorite artist became your favorite artist? They got played at your local radio station. Rock, pop, country, R&B, folk, rap, psychedelia, it's all great. Come hear your next favorite artist on The Dweezil Show, Saturday night, 7 to 9 p.m., right here on 91.5 WMFO and on WMFO.org.
Midnight to the edge of life. Demon in the darkness has a subtle bite. Bones start to boiling, dreams they run cold. Method turn to madness, your ticket will explode. The golden phoenix, ride that Valkyrie. You were just a plaything, nothing more to me. Never gonna co-sign your insanity. Don't know why it should be a god. Playing that game no more. people with your razor knife. Once you cross the threshold.
There we go. Good afternoon. Chuck Morse, welcome to the program. Sorry I'm a bit late. Mainly stuck at that Mass Pike traffic. And also having a little trouble getting my car started this morning. But I am here doing the show, as I am known to do, every Thursday, 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Right here at WMFO in Medford. You're welcome to join the program, of course, 855-915-9636. What is on your mind this afternoon? 855-915-9636. As I catch my breath, running up the stairs and getting in here on time, here I am. It's great to be here. Let's see. Let me just see if I can shut down the sound panel, just because I'm supposed to do that. We'll push stop. There we go. Well, as I said, I'm rushing in. My mind is running squirming like a toad, as the Doors might have said. But I have some things on my mind I thought I'd bring up. I'll ask a basic question here. Are the Trump haters mentally ill? Are the Trump haters mentally ill? And I think that the broad, general, short answer is that they're not mentally ill, but they're not mentally healthy either. Now, what do I mean by the Trump haters? I'm not talking about people who are fully conscious, fully witting opponents of the Trump administration. They're not mentally ill. They're fine. They know why they oppose Trump, and they want to stop him. They want to take him out. Those are people who want to prevent what Donald Trump is trying to do as President of the United States. And that is, as his chief strategist, Stephen K. Bannon, so carefully articulated during the CPAC convention, that is that he wants to dismember or dismantle the administrative state. That is exactly what the conservative movement has talked about, going all the way back to when the state really started ramping up. That was in the early part of the 20th century, when we saw the phenomena of our representative government being transferred to an administrative-style governance. When governing powers that, according to the Constitution and according to the traditional notions of American government and the things that have made us as powerful and as successful as we are as a people and as a civilization, and that is elected government, limited government, were transferred piece by piece to appointed, unaccountable, unfaceless bureaucrats who would be making decisions over our lives without us knowing it. It's a trend that has been gaining steam in this country, going back, frankly, to the Wilson administration. You could argue even before that. You could argue Teddy Roosevelt was into it, even going as far back as Lincoln. But the point is that during Wilson, who was an avowed socialist, governing powers were transferred to agencies, because Wilson and his socialist clique felt that the average citizen in America was either not capable of self-government or was too stupid to engage in self-government or just couldn't understand the real goals of government, which to their opinion were active as opposed to passive, and that they would seize the reins of government and perpetrate it in a way that would basically fulfill its own power. They were backed by the very, very rich back then, and they still are, most of whom are on the left. And they began to move areas of government where we, the people, would have a say over what happened to bureaucracies. Health, education, welfare, policing, law and order. All of these things, which originally were controlled by the people through their elected representatives, would gradually be shifted to unelected agencies and experts, people who, it created the whole cottage industry for the educated, quote unquote, people who maybe go to Tufts University, public administrators, who would then be in a position to decide how we should live, what we should eat, what our health care would look like, what our children's education would look like. They would make decisions, moral decisions, in the place of the family, which they despise. Now, I'm being very broad here, but more specifically, the situation did start to ramp up under the Roosevelt administration when Franklin Roosevelt, in his inaugural address, basically declared a state of emergency under the guise that because of the Depression and the stock market crash, he needed emergency powers. And he got approval from Congress to essentially operate in a state of war. And he mentioned this explicitly in his inaugural. Except instead of being at war with a foreign power, technically, he would be at war, the government would be at war with the American people. And thus, the government would become almost a corporation. This, by the way, in a small sense, it reminds me of a more recent situation, which is when Obamacare was passed, where the government attempts to move in the direction of complete control over our health, which is over our lives and over our deaths. They made an exemption for Congress. So the Congress and its staff members would not have to deal with Obamacare. That's just for the rest of us. And in the process of doing this, they essentially declared Congress to be a corporation that would be exempted, just like the companies and the corporations in Nancy Pelosi's congressional district. They would be exempted from Obamacare. The Obamacare was just for us ignorant people who need the government to control our health. But anyway, so the situation began to accelerate under Roosevelt with the establishment of all of these agencies that would basically decide areas of agriculture, commerce, prices of goods and services, labor, education, all of it. And some of the excesses of which were eventually thrown out by the Supreme Court, and Roosevelt responded to that. Maybe he was reading the Workers' Weekly World that day. I don't know, but it was a communist agenda. And that was to pack the Supreme Court with more judges that people he could control. It didn't work, thank God. And this country was able to, at least we as a people, were able to continue to retain at least a certain degree of our sovereignty as human beings and of our ability to function as free people. Roosevelt's took on the the Wilson Doctrine as well when he further entangled the United States into an international network of perpetual war and treaties that would turn the United States ultimately, in terms of their ultimate goal, into a province of the world, into basically, you know, part of a world order. Now, this, and by the way, I'm researching a book right now. I think I've mentioned this before. Fascinating research. The assassinations, attempted assassinations, plots, conspiracies in America. And I'm up to the Kennedy assassination. And I was thinking about this business of perpetual war when I studied the Kennedy assassination, why it happened. And given the fact that there is so much information about the Kennedy assassination that remains classified, which in and of itself is indications of a conspiracy, why else would they classify information at this point? Kennedy offered, gave an interview in September of 1963 with Walter Cronkite on the lawn of Hyannisport. It was summer. There's a film of it. You can see his family members playing touch football and just having a nice summer day. And in the course of that interview, and part of the interview apparently was classified or was not released to the public until, I don't know, the 1970s or 80s. Kennedy declared his intention to withdraw all American military personnel from Vietnam. Now, this was at a time when there was a great deal of clamor on the part of what President Eisenhower, in his last moments in office, the night before his step, he left, referred to the military-industrial complex without really telling us what that was. The military-industrial complex, the generals, the big corporations, the liberal Eastern Seaboard establishment, which is what I'd call it, they were pressuring Kennedy to escalate the war in Vietnam. They wanted more troops on the ground, right? Kennedy told Cronkite that he did not think this was going to happen under his watch. He felt that the South Vietnamese had to fight their own war, that it was a civil war, and that if they didn't have the will to fight, then it was not sensible for us to go in and fight it for them. They had to want to win. They had to want to establish their freedom against communism. That he would continue to offer economic aid, that he would offer training, that he'd offer military hardware, but he would not commit American troops. Now, it was about a month later, in October of 1963, that President Kennedy signed a memorandum calling for the withdrawal of 1,000 American military troops by the end of 1963, which seems to imply that he would have gone another step further and gradually phased out American involvement in Vietnam altogether. Now, that didn't mean that he was pro-communist. It wasn't that he wanted to support North Vietnam. Quite the contrary. He wanted to stand with the South Vietnamese, both in terms of financial aid, economic aid, moral support, probably a good deal of media support and all the rest, and hope that South Vietnam, under those conditions, would be able to fight against the North and insert its sovereignty. Now, unfortunately, John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963, and within days of the assassination, while his body was still lying in state at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda, President Johnson met with the generals and he planned escalation. He canceled Kennedy's memorandum. He rescinded it. And thus he escalated the war in Vietnam. And what happened was, of course, you know, 8 years later and the deaths of almost 60,000 Americans, not to mention how many thousands of Vietnamese, Vietnam finally collapses to the North Vietnamese. Now, that's another question and another story. But the point that I would make is that had Kennedy lived, the American entanglement in Vietnam would not have happened, and that Vietnam would have either asserted its sovereignty and established its nationhood on its own with great American help, or they would have collapsed in the face of the North Vietnamese onslaught. But either way, there would not have been a war. It would have been a minor footnote on the pages of history, that we would have saved up to 60,000 American lives, not to mention American treasure, not to mention American wounded and American missing in action, not to mention American prestige. And communism still would not have won because Kennedy was, Kennedy's policy eventually would be echoed and carried out exactly by President Ronald Reagan, who was able to defeat, along with his allies, he was able to defeat the Soviet Union itself without firing a single shot. He didn't send troops to attack Moscow. Instead, he encircled Russia. He ratcheted up the sort of what you might call propaganda. I mean that in the best sense of contrasting their rotten system and evil society with our superior one. He tightened the economic screws on Russia. He actually brought corporate heads into the White House and asked them privately as voluntarily citizens, he couldn't force it, to not enter into contracts with Russia and to tighten up the contracts they had with Russia only in terms of what they absolutely had to do and to basically tighten the screws on Russia. The result was that Russia collapsed without America engaging in these entangling alliances. I think Kennedy would have done as Reagan did in the 1980s. Yes, have a military strike, but do it in a way that's successful. You go in, you win it, and you get out. You don't stay there and bleed the country and bleed the United States. This is part of this sort of, I guess you might say this administrative state aspect. Get the United States permanently entangled as a mercenary force into the rest of the world. So we're constantly fighting wars. We're constantly losing our treasure. We're losing our young men and women to needless, senseless battles, which are rigged from the beginning in a way that would almost guarantee that we're going to lose. And the result is that America gradually merges, or as they said during the Roosevelt years, there's a convergence into sort of a world informal order. Now, when I talk about world order, I'm not talking about an outright one world government. That's not what I mean. I understand that people may think those things, and there's been conspiracy theories about that. I'm not into that. I'm suggesting it's more of an informal, unelected world order where you have people who are in very high positions of wealth and power controlling the world's money, controlling the world's political systems while leaving the nation states in place, at least in the du jour sense, and controlling the world's culture. That's what I think is going on, and that's what I think Kennedy stood up against, and that's why I believe he was assassinated without knowing any of the details. I don't know any more about it than anyone else, and I don't claim to know more. But there were some radical changes after Kennedy died. The country lurched much further to the left. We began to develop much more of a nanny state under the guise of an emergency, which we were told was because of the assassination. And we began to get involved in these international entangling wars, like Vietnam particularly. And of course, the Bushes continue to carry on with that. Well, now here we are with Donald Trump. And Trump says, I'm going to dismantle this state. I'm going to drain the swamp. I'm going to return governing powers to the people. And he begins to do this, and it's driving these elites crazy. Although these people, again, to get back to my original theme, they are not mentally ill. They know exactly what they're doing. They are part of an international order. They want to create this informal world government. I'm going to call it what it is. And they do not want to have that interrupted by someone who is, as they call him, a populist. someone who's going to return governing powers to the people. And so thus they launch this the most vicious and the most constant and prolonged propaganda campaign against Donald Trump that I have ever seen and that I think has ever happened in our lifetimes. Now, I think clearly President Trump has some of these, you know, liberal change agents in his administration. There's no question about that. And he makes a nod to it. President Kennedy did as well. You can't, you know, you don't live unless you do. You know, and I think in particular, we can take a look at this General McMaster as a change agent in the Trump White House. But putting that aside, he is still moving step by step toward returning powers to the people. Ironically, the Orwellian media claims that he's being fascist, that he wants to have extra powers. Quite the opposite. But getting back to the question of whether or not the Trump haters are crazy, whether or not they're insane, whether or not they're mentally ill, what I would say is this. The real people in real positions of influence who are driving the Trump-hating movement, they are not mentally ill. They are fully conscious, witting participants in a propaganda campaign to stop any threat to their power, to their agenda, to their business. We're talking about the top 1% here, and to their ideological beliefs, which is that there's some virtue in world government. They are protecting what they've accomplished, which is a lot from their perspective, over the past 100 years. The people that are suffering from mental ill health are not them, but they are the consumers of this propaganda, and they are the people on the left, and even the moderate left. They are people who are consuming on a day-to-day basis in this constant drumbeat that emanates from TV, from radio, from the internet, from their Facebook page. This anti-Trump drumbeat. And it's totally driving them crazy. They are becoming unhealthy. They are becoming unhinged. And I would suggest to my listening audience here at Tufts that this is an experiment possibly in mind control. You know, liberals have generally and unconsciously, and again, I'm not talking about the conscious people. I'm talking about your average liberal, your student, perhaps, at Tufts University. You know, you're a resident of a trendy community somewhere in Cambridge. I don't know, wherever. That they have embraced a bill of goods, thinking that they are doing good and sincerely thinking this. You know, look, the left appeals to the better side of our nature. We want to help our fellow man. That's a natural part of being alive. We want to do good in the world. We want to make some kind of a difference to give our own life a sense of meaning. We want to help our neighbor in need. That's normal. That's natural. But the left will tell them that by embracing leftism, which is to say letting them have authority in government, then the liberal can feel like they are doing good for their neighbor, for their country, for the world, without actually doing a damn thing, right? It's kind of a subtle thing. You know, I had someone tell me recently, I said to them, well, you know, the United States is one of the freest civilizations ever. We're also the most generous. We also have done more charitably speaking, both as a people and as a nation, to people in need. And that's a fact. So hasn't, by the way, the Catholic Church. But in this case, I'm talking about the United States. And their response to me was, well, we didn't do it. We didn't do it because we actually want to help anybody. We did it because we make money from it or something like that. And I was thinking about that, you know. First of all, the person that said this to me is someone who, as a woman of the left, I really don't think she's ever done anything in her life to help anyone else. I mean, other than herself. But putting that aside, she feels like she's helping other people just by virtue of the fact that she genuflects to the left. But the fact is that, you know, leftism and leftist governments and leftist systems, they haven't helped anybody. They've created poverty and suffering. Look at Venezuela. You can't even get a damn roll of toilet paper in that country. And it used to be one of the best economies in Latin America. You're not helping anybody by turning what is natural to human beings over to a government. You know, I don't necessarily trust private citizens. And I don't trust corporations to do good. Many of them don't. Many of them are corrupt. Many of them are, you know, crooked. But I would rather have private corporations and private citizens competing in the open market, handling things like social services, helping, you know, insurance companies, giving people insurance if they have an emergency, whatever, homeless shelters, actually helping people get, you know, off the street and get back into homes. These are all things that we want as a people. I would rather trust the private vendor to do this, even if they fail, than to let the government have a monopoly on it, in which case you know they're going to fail. You know it's going to be a disaster. But these liberals who have bought this bill of goods and who think that there's something virtuous about simply turning these powers over to a government, they have come to believe, because they follow this party line, this propaganda, that Donald Trump is evil and is bad, that it has taken already an insane idea that at its core is creating a dissonance against their own nature, and it is amplifying it to the point where they are becoming unhinged. I've seen this. I've seen this among several people in my own life who, since the election, and these are not stupid people, they've become completely unhinged over the election of Trump. And these are not people who know or give a damn about dismantling the administrative state. They don't even know why. They just, it's like a computer chip has been implanted in the back of their skulls, and it's stimulated, and they just respond. I think what we're seeing here is an example of mass mind control. That's what I think. And I think that the results are very dangerous, not only for the individuals involved, ultimately, but for our country, if, God forbid, they win. Now, let me talk about the possibility that they might win. They might win because they've got this guy, Robert Mueller, conducting an independent investigation. I've heard him described as a dirty cop. Why? Because as FBI director, he did nothing in the face of many, many scandals, mostly in the Obama administration, but also in the Bush administration. He was a court person. He was a swamp rat, if you will. He was part of this establishment. He wasn't there to prosecute a genuine crime. Like, for example, the Fast and Furious scandal, where the government was caught running guns to drug gangs in Mexico. Or the Lois Lerner scandal, where the IRS was caught investigating groups on a list who were not in favor, who were not predisposed favorably to the Obama administration. Those are scandals, huge scandals. But Mueller, as the head of the FBI, did absolutely nothing to investigate them. But now he's being brought in as the shining knight on a white horse to investigate alleged collusion between Donald Trump and his campaign and Russia. He's not going to look into, at least as far as we know, why the DNC is not turning over their email servers to the FBI. He's not going to look into the Hillary Clinton email scandal where she erased 33,000 emails that were under subpoena from the FBI. I mean, that's right under their noses, but they're not going to look at that. They're not going to look at possible collusion on the part of Attorney General Loretta Lynch and her meeting with the husband of the main focus of an FBI investigation on the tarmac, and then the investigation basically goes away. That's collusion. He's not going to probably look into Hillary Clinton's deal as Secretary of State with Russia, with a shell company of Russia, to purchase 20% of America's uranium supplies in exchange for unknown amounts of money pouring into the Clinton Foundation and Bill Clinton getting a speaking job, a quick speaking engagement in Moscow for $500,000. He's probably not going to look into that either. And those are all things that absolutely smack of collusion. Instead, he's looking into whether or not this cockamamie left-wing conspiracy theory, which holds that somehow the Trump campaign colluded with Russia in order to win the election. Completely unproven, admittedly as such, by Senator Dianne Feinstein, no friend of the Trump administration, who, when asked about it, admitted that they had nothing. They had rumors they were looking into. And even Maxine Waters, who's calling every other day to impeach not only Trump, but she wants to impeach Pence. She's admitted that there's nothing hard yet found, but they're going to keep looking. They've been looking for almost a year now. In fact, it's been a year because it started last August. And you now have three different congressional investigations, plus you've got the FBI, plus you've got the special prosecutor. And they found nothing. So what is Robert Mueller doing? Instead of looking at the Trump-Russia collusion, since there's nothing there, now apparently he's turning to looking at President Donald Trump's private dealings as a businessman before he was president. Now, this is the kind of thing that's done in socialist countries like National Socialist Germany under Hitler, or in third world sort of banana republics where you've got unstable dictators who are taken out every other day. This is not the kind of thing that is commensurate to our American approach to government. We don't have to bring somebody in and have them completely investigated for their entire life because we don't like their politics. I mean, if President Trump did something illegal, fine. Let somebody bring up charges against him. But to have a government-paid special prosecutor bringing on his staff enemies of the political enemies of the administration, people who were Hillary Clinton partisans and who were contributors to the Clinton campaign, to investigate him, that should be chilling to every American who cares about freedom. I understand some of you out there despise Trump, you think you despise Trump, but I would ask you, do you feel comfortable with such a phenomena where the government is going to investigate a public official for things that maybe he did? Maybe he bought a house in 10 years ago and it was not signed properly, or, you know, this or that. The only way such behavior could be approved, and this is, I suppose, what Mueller is depending on, is that it's going to fall upon this irrational Trump hatred, or it's going to fall upon a hatred for capitalism. Trump is a capitalist. He's made a lot of money in business. So there's an inherent hatred for that. The fact that he is America's first businessman to serve as president, actually. You know, this is a lot to do with fueling the hatred of this man and of his administration. Now, that doesn't mean that legitimate people can't criticize the Trump administration and its actions, nor does it mean that they can't criticize Donald Trump as a person and some of his antics and the things that he says and all the rest. That is perfectly appropriate. I don't have a problem with that. I do it myself. But what we see going on here is beyond that. What we see going on here is a willingness to step outside of not only the Constitution, by which Trump was elected president, but conventional means of dealing with law and justice in this country going back to the founding. You know, our law and our custom, in order to destroy Trump because of this hatred. And I do think that the hatred is based, again, on what looks to me to be what I can only describe as mind control. Wake up. Wake up, my listeners. Wake up. Put aside your personal animus and your partisan politics and take a look at where we are as a country and where we might be if we lose Trump. Doesn't mean you have to like everything he does, as I've said. Doesn't mean you have to like everything about him as a person, as I've said. But this is an opportunity for us to right the ship of state. Get back to our intent to be a self-governing people, to clean out the rot, clean out the swamp, as he keeps saying. You know, you want to have international order? Well, fine. Let's have an open debate about it. Let's do it in the broad daylight, which is, of course, what they don't want. Let's think about the motivations of the people who are trying to stop Trump. And let's stop them. Let's stop them before they stop us. Anyways, Zach is here. I was a little late today, so the program will be was somewhat truncated. I got stuck in traffic and my car towed, so it was stopped. So I walked in the building, I think, at about 12 after, and so... Okay. No, that's okay. The main question, I'm glad you're here, Zach, because as usual, I'm so ham-handed on matters of winding things down.
Just click any of the PSAs.
Any of the PSAs. Yeah, but I want to do it the right way. Should I click this?
Automation.
I want to try that right here, right?
Nope.
Automation is...
Well, let me guide you.
All right. There we go. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. I shall return, God willing, next Thursday at 10 a.m. right here at WMFO Medford Tufts University. Have a good day, everybody.
And now you put five up.
Five goes up. And...